Tuesday, March 21st, 1972, talking with the Reverend Mr. Jacob David Townsend at his home in Bel Air, Maryland. Mr. Townsend, of the books you have written, which do you like the best?
I don't think I have any favorite novels. The little book that has had the least sale is the Five Trials of the Apache Band. And I have no idea why that book has sold. I thought that probably more of my suffering in that little book than any other. I thought it was quite a sensitively written book, going into the inner recesses of a child's mind. And evidently, everybody doesn't agree with me, although most children have liked it. Did you like it?
Yes, but not as much as the others.
I see.
I think there was the humor and the
yes.
fun in the others was a little more intense.
Yes. There may have been less of myself in the others than there was than in that book, which would be the reason why I was more more of a portrait of my own children.
You're too close to it, maybe.
Maybe. We're not able to judge, you know. The writer is poorest critic. You'll write a page that you think is very beautiful, and some person who really knows, some genuine critic will say, oh, that's bad. That's cheap, you know what I mean? As one lady said to me, that's corn. And I realized it, rewrote it. I think it would be very wonderful if we writers could have honest criticism without having to pay for it and go through the publishing houses. But if we had readers who genuinely knew what is good, they could say to us what we can't say to ourselves. Now, I think a Shakespeare didn't need outside criticism. He not only could write, but he had that judgment balance that he could impartially look at his own page and say that isn't perfect. There are other writers who've been able to do it. I don't think Balzac could. I think most of his pages aren't working very much. But
how about your family? Are they good credit?
They are not good credit. They're too favorable. I guess they're afraid of hurting. Even probably when they don't like it, they'll say, well, that's good. No, your family, they're very bad. Now, the children in your family might be more honest.
You mean as your grandchildren?
Yeah, grandchildren might. If there were anything they didn't like, they would certainly not tell you their pitiless. Also, if they do like it, you know it's pretty good.
And I believe you said that the Pansy Bed was based loosely on an experience of your children.
That was a real experience of one of my daughters who walked through grow pansies in a shady corner.
And before that, you had written The Cat Stands Accused, which was based on an ounce of goodness.
But it was based on an actual fact. We did have two cats and one of the kittens. They were quite extraordinary cats. At that time, I was teaching in the American High School, and one of my pupils was the son of the ambassador from Thailand. We called it Siam, quite a while ago. And that boy brought to the headmaster of the school a Siamese cat who was 100% Siamese, as it had come from the royal household. So the father, the ambassador, gave this Siamese female to the headmaster. But alas, the female escaped and got out in the street and mated with an alley cat and had five kittens. And they were certainly not Siamese. They were just ordinary black cats. Well, the headmaster said, what am I going to do with these kittens? They're not worth anything. I said, I'll take one. We haven't any cats. So I took a female who was Siamese to the extent that she was arrogant, she scratched, she had a dreadful voice. She had a Siamese voice. We fell in love with her because of her independent spirit and her naughtiness. We called her Griffet, which means scratcher. griffe is the verb to scratch. Mm. So we called her Griffet. Griffet got out in the alley and had kittens. We saved only one of those kittens. The little kitten is black as ink. Nothing Siamese about it, not even its cry. Mm. And we generally went to the south of France for our summer vacation, where we had a house built in 1255, as well as we can discover, which we were restoring. So we took the two cats with us, and they settled in very much at home. Well, there my story begins. We had neighbors, Dutch people, who had come from New Amsterdam and bought a ruin in this ancient town. These people had two little girls. The two little girls had two guinea pigs. And one day, one of the little girls came over and informed us that our cat had eaten one of her guinea pigs. It seemed logical, because Griffet was the type of cat that would eat a hippopotamus if she could get it down. Well, we didn't believe it, because when we went over to look at the cage, it had a latch on it that could certainly not have been moved by a cat's paw. And we felt that the guinea pig must have been taken by someone who would eat it, for folks eat guinea pigs in Italy and the south of France. In fact, there was one old man there, an enemy of these Dutch people, who would have been only too glad to play a dirty trick on them. And he admitted that he had eaten guinea pig and liked it, although we didn't question him as to whether he'd eaten that particular guinea pig.
Is this who you based salt?
Yes, his name is Gonzalo, kind of a Spanish man. A dirty old man. Didn't like this family at all. He liked them so little that one day when Mrs. Duvendijk, the Dutch lady, was serving tea in her backyard, he shook a pair of dirty pants over the fence, because she had once accused him of having fleas. And he evidently thought he'd shake his fleas into her yard. So he could very well have eaten the guinea pig. But everything seemed to be against our poor cats, because the day after the loss of the guinea pigs, we found our two cats tearing at an animal's skin, a fur. And when I took it from them, I found it to be a guinea pig skin. Now, we concluded that instead of being evidence against the cats, that was evidence for the cats, for the guinea pig skin was intact. And we knew that if cats ate a guinea pig, they certainly would have to eat a part of the skin, wouldn't they? Mm-hmm. And we therefore said this was skinned by a human hand. And the skin was thrown away, and somebody ate the animal. That's as far as we got. We never could prove or disprove. But that created enmity among the children. But we didn't stay there very much longer, because on the 30th of August that year, war was declared. And immediately life was turned topsy-turvy. We were advised to return to Paris while we could get passage on the train. And we went back to Paris, leaving the two cats with a farm lady. We never saw them again, but we did learn that the kittens, whom we had called George, had kittens and was therefore a female and should have been called Georgette. We never heard the cats again.
But years later, in 1961 it was, that you wrote the book, or had it published,
yes.
And you added something to it, the trial.
I added the trial to it, because it seemed evident that if we could have had a trial down there and had impartial judgment, I mean a toy or a game trial, we could have done something about clearing the reputation of the cats. And so I imagined this trial. I wrote the book in about 2 weeks, because it was all in my head. And this book was taken by the first publisher to whom I submitted. Of course, Houghton Mifflin had already published my translation of the Poland-Russian campaign, which had had considerable success.
And they published
this? They published this right away.
And you had an illustrator, as you have for all of your books.
I have had nothing to do with the choice of the illustrator. Oh. I have left that in the hands of the publisher, and they have always made a good choice.
Do you ever meet the artist?
Never have met the illustrator. The nearest I got to it was writing to the illustrator of Miss Laputi. I appreciated his work so much that I wrote congratulating him, saying that I hope one day, months ago, and my letter has never been answered. So I don't know. He's a very well-known illustrator.
Is it Gorey you pronounce
it? Yes, Gorey. He was quoted he was mentioned by, in an article in Time, New York Times Literary Supplement, as one of the 10 leading illustrators of children's books.
They're certainly charming, that old hat
that she's got on. I've seen another book that was illustrated by him. I think it was reviewed in New York Times as a copy of one of his pictures.
Then you don't choose your publisher either. You just go around feeling for a
publisher? No, you choose him. You mail your manuscript to a publisher, and if he wants it, he takes it and sends it back. Usually send it back without any comment, whatever.
And then you try another one. And you have the three children's books. You're writing on a fourth one about the charming story of a little girl who came over here. And when do you think that will be done?
Several months. Yes, it will require a lot of work. Oh, an interesting thing about Miss Tuckley. Now, Houghton Mifflin had published three books of mine, The Polish Russian Campaign, Can't Stand Accused, and The Five Trials of Strangibet. They refused the manuscript of Miss Tuckley. Isn't that interesting?
Did they give any reason?
Yes, they gave reasons, because by now I was a member of their family. They talked it over with me. They said the book was not a book-length book. It was more like a short story. They couldn't see publishing a book. So they sent it back. Then I sent it to Lothrop, and they took it.
Well,
it
is short.
I never told them that it had been refused by Houghton Mifflin.
No. Well, it is shorter than the others, and
it's a very short book. It was only 20 pages of typed manuscript.
And it's very funny. And you had a little story about the ending, that it was changed.
So the ending, as I submitted it to both publishers, that may have been the reason why Houghton Mifflin didn't want it, but they didn't say so. Although Lothrop frankly said they liked the story. In fact, they had paid me an amount of money to bind the contract. And then they said, we don't like the ending, and we'd like you to change it. We would suggest that you don't kill Miss Tuckley for her crimes, but that you let her live and you let her become a regenerated good old lady.
Even though your killing was a very novel one?
My killing wasn't very novel. The devil just stuck her in his stocking, in her own stocking.
Well, that doesn't happen every day.
So I gave the more happy ending of a lady who, this is an amusing detail, at the very end of the book, after I had changed the ending, I had a little letter. I said that Miss Tuckley repented of having treated her family so badly, and she sat down that very night and wrote a letter saying, come back, and I will give you all kinds of good food. To my dear aunt, I promise that I will buy her a set of new false teeth. You see, she had only two teeth, and she had broken one of them chewing the bone.
Right.
So now the publisher took that letter out. I wonder why. They took the letter out. Then a little farther along, when Tuckley found that her life was spared, she danced for the first time in 50 years. They kept that. But she threw open the door, and she called out to the warm south wind and the swallows on the telephone wire, I'm free, I'm free. They cut it out. I thought that was the best part of my book.
The reason why the publishers.
Yeah. I was so exasperated at one point I wrote a letter saying, I'll send you back the advance, send you back my manuscript. Then the head publisher, editor-in-chief, phoned me and apologized for the editor. She had not been doing the work, a sub-editor, said, I assure you, I had no further trouble. I'd had enough of that.
So there weren't any more changes after that?
No, that's what it is.
Oh, that's interesting. You have had less trouble with the rest of your publishers. Of the children's book, eh?
I wrote to the editor of Little Rock. The two children's books, edited by Houghton Mifflin, were not changed. Only one word in the entire manuscript, the cat's bandicoot, was changed. I remember what it was. I used the old English word acetyl by the fireplace.
Oh, yeah.
They put in the word couch, which of course is different. Now, you see, I recall that change. The manuscript were taken as I sent them.
That says a lot right there, doesn't it?
Yes.
Because they spent so much time on them.
I think I was unfortunate. The editor-in-chief at Lothra turned my manuscript over to one of their workers. You see, you are given an edit.
Yeah.
And my editor told me that it was Mrs. Harmon, and we worked together beautifully.
Now, this next book that you're writing on the girl Anna, is that going to be submitted to Houghton Mifflin?
No. I will submit it to my present publisher.
Are you under contract?
I was under contract. I was under contract to submit my next manuscript.
Mm.
I submitted it to them, and they didn't want it.
And which was that?
So now I'm free. But I am courtesy enough to submit that, first of all, my next book. Yeah.
Did you do that on purpose? That manuscript that had been making the rounds, did you feel they would not accept it? I mean, you hoped
no,
they would.
I was hoping they would, because they've been favorable to one. They did not think anyone was polite. They said they felt that they would have no appeal to American readers.
Mm-hmm.
They may be true, I don't know.
And that is geared to the older child, the high school age.
Yes, that's geared to high school age.
The Napoleon Russian campaign translation was a translation by whom? It was by you, but who was the original writer?
Philip de Segur, Count Philip de Segur. And he was the son of Count de Segur, who was the ambassador from the court to France to the court of Catherine of Russia. And the writer of this book, Philip de Segur, was brought up partly in the Russian court. Knew the ways of the world, and did not think he ever would write. He became a soldier, rapidly became a general, and then became the aide-de-camp and advisor or confidant of Napoleon, and was able to write about Napoleon as no other person could. And he wrote about that tragic year. The book was entitled The History of Napoleon and the Grand Army during the year 1812.
Hmm.
Now that book would have over 600 typed pages, and I edited and cut it down to 300 of my pages.
Hmm. You paraphrased a lot.
That didn't paraphrase a word.
I
only omitted.
Oh.
I didn't alter a word. I omitted chapters, entire chapters of military technique and things that wouldn't interest a reader today. Now, Houghton Mifflin first gave my manuscript to the head of the French department at Harvard, who is a master around the French literature. And he passed on it without my knowing it, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
They submitted it to him, and he said yes. Translation, and the book was worth translating. And then later, the head of the Department of French at Oxford wrote a review for the BBC publication. And I have that review. It was most flattering. He said, "We have long waited for an adequate translation of this great book. Finally, Mr. Townsend has given it to us." And then he approved of the editing. That's what I'm afraid
yeah.
of, because I'm not a historian. I dared edit a history book of that value. Of course,
how did you dare?
What did you say?
How did you dare? What made you do it?
Well, I realized, I said to the publisher, I realized, as you will, that if this book were translated verbatim, as it was in 1824, I found a copy of a translation in the Widener Library at Harvard of the 1824 translation of Sigler's book. Now, you couldn't read it today. You'd have to go through it and fish out the pearls.
Well, what made you want to do it in the first place?
Oh, dear, that's a story. When I was a kid, as I told you, I lived on books. I had an insatiable appetite for books, books far beyond my years. My school reader, fifth or sixth grade school reader, had one chapter of this early translation, this 1824 translation of Segur's book. This chapter was the burning of Moscow. I never forgot it. It made an indelible impression upon me. And when I went to France and lived in France and read France, I got the entire book. And I was bored. It took me days to get through the book and find that chapter, which had thrilled me when I was a boy, and I found it in French. Well, the years went by, and I remembered. I thought to myself, that book ought to be translated. So I translated this chapter. That's the chapter that I submitted to Oxford Press and the different ones, and finally submitted to Houghton Mifflin, and telling them that, giving them an outline of the book and telling them, this is just as you may judge of the translation. But I would edit the book so that it would be readable today. I sent them a copy in French of the book. And I proceeded to edit it. And it evidently met with their approval. My editor at Houghton Mifflin suggested that I retain one chapter which I had cut out, and I did.
Hmm. Well, that was a very scholarly thing. How come you
said... Oh, it needed a tremendous amount of research, because I wouldn't write a man's name unless I knew whom I was writing about. I went to the Widener Library over and over again to get books that I couldn't find anywhere else. I needn't have done it. A translator might even just satisfy himself to slavishly translate. Mm-hmm. But wherever I would find, I would find, for instance, the Prince of Muscovy. Who in the world is the Prince of Muscovy? But he was none other than Marshal Ney. Who was Marshal Ney? Well, he was Antoine Ney, whom Napoleon had made Marshal, and then for his success, he made him Prince of Muscovy, which is Moscow, because of his fighting the Battle of Borodino, which was called the Battle of Moscow. And so I had a footnote to find it in my book. Who was Prince Moscow? Who was the Prince of Westphal? Well, Prince of Westphal was none other than Josephine's son, Napoleon's stepson, Eugene. See, all these things I thought added in the footnote.
How long did it take you?
Oh, 3 years. But I rewrote my manuscript 3 times. I had a pile of typed pages like that.
Well, do you feel like it's coming up in the world or down in the world from very scholarly work to Miss Plafoody?
Up in the world. In that case, I was only imitating.
And these are children's books for you.
I'm creating a nonsense book, if you will. But
why children's book?
I think children are our most enthusiastic and appreciative readers. You know that. I have been thrilled by reading great books. Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment and The Idiot lifted me into a higher world, but I doubt whether I got the real enjoyment out of them that I got out of reading some of the books I read as a child. I never liked those series of books about the boys who began in bootblacks and ended up as president. I never seemed to like them, but I did like Victor Hugo's Les Misérables and Toilers of the Sea. I got a hold of, I don't know how. I did like Eugène Grandet and Balzac. I'm speaking of English translations, of course. And I did like Uncle Tom's Cabin. And Gulliver's Travels, Robinson Crusoe, and all those books, really and truly.
What we call the classics.
Yes. And I think the one that affected me most was Stephen. They meant to get the gold.
With the kidnapped?
No, the other one. Is that
odd? Black Arrow. There's
a Long John Silver in there.
Yeah, isn't that kidnapped? I think. Yeah.
Angels.
We'll have to check on that. We'll have to do a little research on that.
As I said, those are the books that I think gave me more pleasure. Not an intellectual pleasure or a critical pleasure, but that...
Treasure Island.
Yes, that pleasure which has no name, which is just pure. So, if I can give any children that amount of pleasure or anything like it, I shall feel my time as well spent.
Your own children do get a lot of pleasure, I'm told, by other people. Have the other people's children, do you get a lot of response?
I get a lot of favorable comments, yes.
Do you talk with the local kids at all in the library?
Oh,
or
I have
school?
Spoken in every school in the county, I guess, more than once or twice on children's books, how to write them, how to read them. And each time they will ask me questions about my own book, which delights me that they're wanting to know about it.
What kind of questions?
Oh, when did you begin to write it? How did you write it? Where did you get the title?
Was
it
even
a true
story?
And they're the questions that come and I answer.
Do you feel that this is will instill in them any desire to read or to write?
Some of them have a desire to write. And then I encourage them.
Well, children's books aren't the only thing you've written, though. You have written many articles on music and religion.
My first
religion.
Book was a book on religious music, yeah.
And what was the title?
And I had two books translated from French into English, published in London, just at the time the Second World War began. I never did see one of them. I have a copy of the first one.
What was the title?
Oh, they were both religious subjects. One was prophecies that I've seen fulfilled, and the other one was the mystery of the lost tribes of Israel. And they're long out of print. I translated them for money. I paid so much a page. I was not sympathetic with the subject, you see what I mean?
Yeah.
But I guess
fine.
I did a good job.
Is it harder to do a book when you're not sympathetic with the subject?
It doesn't make much difference. You've got to be faithful to the text, whether you like it or whether you don't. There's an interesting thing about the Segura family, Segura that wrote Napoleon's Russian campaign. He didn't call it Napoleon's Russian campaign. You see, we took out of this long 600-page history the section only of the campaign, while this history covers an entire year.
Oh, yeah.
The campaign of Russia only covered, let's see, November through spring. Well, the Segura, in his book, claims that Count Rostopchin, who was the governor of Moscow, burned Moscow deliberately in order to drive the French out. The French were there, they had taken it. And he, the military governor of Moscow, gave the official order to burn Moscow. Now, when Tolstoy wrote War and Peace, he says the contrary. And there was quite a controversy about that. And most people believe that it was burned by the carelessness of Napoleon's troops. Nothing could be easier to imagine, for it was a city built largely of wood, and Napoleon's vast army was lodged in that place. But Count Segura's nephew married the daughter of Rostopchin. Now she, calling herself the Countess of Segura, wrote some 20 popular books for children, which are still read, and she signed Countess de Segura, born Rostopchin. That always intrigued me, long before I knew anything about this history. My children read these books and I said, nay, Rostopchin, why did she put that? Well, she put that because she was proud of being the daughter of Prince. She was Prince Rostopchin.
Yeah.
Now, de Segura, being intimate not only with Rostopchin, but with his own niece, say, certainly knew more than Tolstoy did, didn't he?
Oops.
And when he sat down to write that book, and could affirm firsthand that Rostopchin ordered the city to be burned, and turned the prisoners out and paid them to go about with torches. That's the story that Segura tells. Now, we must believe it was true because he knew intimately Prince Rose Spectre. And more intimately, his own niece by marriage, you see. That's interesting, isn't it?
Yes, it certainly is.
But it might.